Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. This week's pod will feature two guests. One is an ongoing conversation that I had with Mark Schofield about quarterbacking, and we're going to highlight our segment where we discuss the age-old debate of sitting or starting rookie quarterbacks. And then Doug Farrar is going to stop by, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Genius of Desperation. All right. Welcome to another episode of the RSP Cast. This is Matt Waldman, and with me is Mark Schofield. We had an excellent episode a few weeks back with Mark where we talked about, you know, how we evaluate quarterbacks, some of the things that have changed. And we looked then at players who are young guys still in the midst of their development, like Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston. And I got some unusual and unexpected answers from Mark about who he would have replaced Tom Brady if Tom Brady started an avocado ice cream stand and quit the NFL right now. But I'm going to welcome Mark back. You can find his work at Pro Football Weekly, at Bleacher Report, as well as, of course, Inside the Pylon, a terrific site. Welcome back, Mark.
Matt, fantastic to be back with you. And that episode, we invented a word. We invented electricism. I mean, yes, how great is that? We're out here making new words on these shows. It's fantastic.
It is, man. And this is one of my favorite times of year because it's a little bit slower. And I love doing work with Mark when we've done the RSP film room together. I've learned stuff from Mark as a result of that. And you know, he's someone I consider a friend who it's kind of funny in this world because we're all writing and we're all busy. And I think, yeah, I can't wait to see you at the Senior Bowl. And then I think, you know, after I say that or we exchange it, I think I'm not going to see him for more than 5 minutes because we're going to be focused on 8 million different things there. And it's not going to happen. So, you know, occasionally I have a phone call here and there, but we're usually in the middle of work. So this is our chance actually to do what we would do on a phone call,
Matt's not joking here. I mean, we literally will sometimes have like hour long phone calls where we just talk about quarterback stuff because we have so much fun doing it. And I hope that comes out in these shows. I think it does. I mean, I think we're going to talk about Patrick Mahomes. I mean, the RSP film when we did on him, where we basically just giggled for 45 straight minutes. Right. I mean, that's kind of what we do anyway. So it's basically just Matt and I catching up and recording it. And we have talked about doing that one of the Senior Bowls where we just sit down next to each other, watch a practice, hit record, and just then make something with it. I still think we could do that. But like you said, we're always running in 18 different directions anyway. And you're chatting with John Elway at Starbucks too. So, you know.
The funniest part about the Patrick Mahomes thing is that, you know, the people listening to that and giggling, listening to us giggle and enjoying that. Well, from what I've heard, apparently Chiefs scouts are doing the same thing with him.
Yeah.
Last year during like on Fridays
scouts, after they were finished. Players were doing that. I mean,
that's true.
Travis Kelce was just basically trying to like hide his enthusiasm for Patrick Mahomes last year. And now he won't have to hide it anymore. But I mean, yeah, he's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, he needs a handy wipe. That's for sure. So a bib and a handy wipe.
But there we go.
So let's. We've talked a little bit about it, which was quarterback development in our last show. But, you know, one of the things that I've seen, I saw Evan Silva, you know, a number of weeks back talk about on Twitter, the whole debate about quarterback development. Should they sit? Should they play right away? And I think he reserved it more towards early first round picks. But Mark, do you think the NFL has a problem with developing quarterbacks? If not, why do you think people see that as a problem? And if you do believe it's a problem, why do you think it is? And what would you like to see changed in a perfect world scenario?
I mean, I think the NFL does, in a sense, have a problem developing quarterbacks because, you know, I think that to some extent we do get overly excited when we see rookie quarterbacks come into the league and we do sort of place higher expectations on them than perhaps are warranted in many cases. So I think the NFL does what it can, but it still has a problem in the sense that under the new terms of the CBA, under the way that quarterbacks have traditionally been handled, there simply isn't enough time. There isn't enough, there aren't enough reps to go around, and there isn't enough patience from an ownership, coaching staff, even fan base perspective at times. And you put all of those things together and you're going to have problems. You're going to have situations where a guy like DeShone Kizer might get run out there and perhaps ruined by Hugh Jackson. You might get situations where other quarterbacks don't get a chance to really truly develop because of the sheer numbers to it. Because, you know, take for example, a guy like Chad Kelly, who I know you're extremely high on. Now he's getting a chance right now, you know, because they've moved on from some quarterbacks. But in some situations, a guy like him might just be on the outside looking in, where he's going to get 1, 2, 3 reps of practice. And that's not going to be enough.
It still may happen.
Yeah.
It still may happen for him.
It still might happen for him that way, you know, because they have Case Keenum, because they invested a first round pick into Paxton Lynch. And if you make that kind of investment, you want to make it work somehow. And so there is this sort of problem. Now, I think that, you know, in a perfect world, obviously, you know, every team has, you know, 75 roster spots to play with. There's more practice time. There's perhaps, you know, a different way to handle sort of development. But the problem is that the NFL just uses the NCAA as their minor league system. And I always bring this sort of this discussion back to Tim Tebow, because Urban Meyer, when he was coaching Tim Tebow, his job was to win the SEC. His job was to win a national championship. And if he could get by with a Tim Tebow's trebuchet-type throw in motion and throwing jump passes on fake QB draws and things like that, he had no impetus to sort of fix the things that he needed to fix. But then he gets to the National Football League and he's a tear down and rebuild who still gets drafted in the first round. And so that's sort of the problem right there, is that the NFL relies on college coaches to do something which isn't in their job description. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is sort of the schematic diversity between what teams are doing in the NFL and what teams are asking their quarterbacks to do in college. But that's where I'm a little bit more optimistic, because we're starting to see some overlap, more and more overlap. And this is sort of a cyclical game, in the sense that when stuff starts to work at the high school level, it trickles up to the college level because the schemes follow the players and the coaches, and eventually it'll work its way up to the National Football League. And we're slowly starting to see stuff like that, with more spreads type stuff, more air raid type stuff, more RPOs and things like that, that these guys have been running since they were, you know, my son's age. You know, now we're asking them to suddenly forego 13 years of experience and do something different. Well, now we're getting the Sean McVays. We're getting the Matt LaFleurs. We're perhaps going to get the Lincoln Rileys of the world, who say, you don't have to do it that way, who have grown up in a different sort of offensive environment and who believe in things like the air raid and the spread and like spreading the field and getting guys open in space, because they don't believe in 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And so I think that that aspect of the problem is slowly going to fix itself just by the sheer passage of time. By the fact that the McVays and the LaFleurs and the kids that grew up playing Madden and spreading the field and going 5 wide are now going to be your offensive coordinators and coaches at the college and the NFL level. And so I think that part will sort itself out. I do think that the initial part to that is the area where there needs to be some sort of fix. And until the NFL decides to either have a you know, minor league system, a true minor league system, or a more developmental league, or just a spring passing league where these guys can get some reps, maybe it's the XFL. I mean, we saw recently that Oliver Luck's going to take over that. Maybe they turn that into not just a show, but an actual sort of development type league. Maybe there's an opportunity to have that sort of developmental type process where the guys get some reps, don't sit there and watch, and then we could see, you know, guys like, say, Chad Kelly, get opportunities, develop themselves, and then parlay that into an NFL career.
I think that's a great answer. And it's funny that you mentioned Oliver Luck, because my first memory of Oliver Luck was as a Cleveland Browns fan, when he was a quarterback trying to earn and maintain the starting job with the Browns in the late 1970s, or at least as a backup to Brian Sipe, I believe, at that point.
Brian Sipe.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. You know, former MVP, former New Jersey. you talk about this, and I think it's a business problem. You kind of outline a lot of things. I think it's also a business problem, because when it comes down to it, it does come down to the ownership and how patient they are. And what you mentioned, the CBA, but the CBA is now paying these quarterbacks less. I mean, what Sam Bradford was making before they changed the CBA and what these top quarterbacks are making is far different. So you would think on at least a financial level, it would encourage a little bit more patience and development time because the investment is less.
You would think. But I mean, I almost fear that there's going to be a flip side to that coin and that – you know, I look at Blake Bortles right now and sort of what he's due over the next couple of years from Jacksonville. And you wonder if more and more teams are going to start moving on from quarterbacks and even go in the other direction, because you can start paying these guys outlandish sums of money. And if they're an elite type talent, you will do that. Or they'll just say, look, we'll draft a quarterback a year or two ahead of schedule and maybe we'll move on. Yeah. Like it just seems the business point is a very good point. I think there is a business aspect to it. I do wonder if we're going to see an evolution of how, you know, players are sort of treated under the terms of this current CBA. Obviously, it's up in a couple of years, which is going to be a fun little fight to look forward to. I look forward to going back to the practice of law for 1 year when we don't have football to cover. But that's another question. That's another point for another time. But I do wonder, like, you know, in New England, we're reading about a punter battle because Ryan Allen, the left-footed punter, is due – you know, for a new contract. He's 28. The Patriots can save $1.5 million, you know, if they do move on from him. Are we going to see more and more teams take that type of approach, even at the quarterback position? That's something I've been wondering.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's interesting because didn't Bortles get an extension?
Yeah, he got an extension. I think like $19 million, like 2 years from now. Yeah. And Bortles at $19
million. And see what Yeah. So, but when I look at that, I think, well, you know, they had the option before, like you said, to part with him early. And they certainly had reasons to do so, considering that he wasn't, you know, preparing on the level that he should have after coming off of a big year. And they decided, well, we'll step once more into the breach here and give him one more shot. But I think when it comes down to it, Mark, you know, you talk about, in addition to the CBA, it's still also, they see the college game as a developmental league when it's not really a developmental league. And then, you know, and that means that owners basically are still on a timeline of coaches having and GMs having 2 to 3 years to prove that they're in the right direction. And usually it's not even in the right direction that they're actually there. And I think that really ruins quarterback development and runs counter to what's happening here. And I don't think the question necessarily is about whether they should be on the field immediately or whether they should, you know, whether they should sit. I'd like to see some intermittent use, you know, kind of intermittent play and use. Because when we think about guys like Drew Brees, or we see, you know, Steve McNair way back in the day, or we look at some of the quarterback, you know, even Aaron Rodgers during, you know, for, you know, when, for a period of time, getting guys a chance to be on the field a little bit and then giving them the opportunity to play and then to be benched, whether it's because of their play, their performance, and they don't get into quicksand because you can get them on the bench and let them watch the game a little bit and calm down or evaluate what they did. Or Kirk Cousins as an example, I think he's the accidental developed quarterback, you know, because everyone talked about, you know, he was under RG3 and he was a guy that was inserted into the lineup and benched and made lots of awful mistakes and developed because he got to be on the field and away from the field. And it wasn't the situation where like Kaiser went through where he didn't, you know, had no veteran in, you know, in the locker room, in the quarterback room. And he was inserted in and hailed as the franchise way too early. And then they threw him under the bus and basically said he doesn't have what it takes after he made a bunch of mistakes and they kept him in the game and his game deteriorated. And I feel like that there's a point where if you're going to throw someone in the pool, when they start to struggle and look like they're going to drown, you pull them out and let them sit if you're going to throw them in, you know, and you want to have someone who knows how to swim along beside them, helping them learn how to do this, you know, so that if they get into some trouble that they have a chance to evaluate what's going on. And it's such a confidence game that it kind of concerns me that really the answer isn't one thing, but it's, but I think part of it is having more quarterbacks who are veterans in the room and knowing what they're there for, signing them for reasons for them there. I have no doubt that Sam Bradford was signed as a guy who can play, but also as a guy that they had to talk to him and said, we're right. going to draft a quarterback and we're probably going to draft one high. And we feel like your experience being in several offenses, good and bad, you know, successful and fail, success and failure, and the way that you handled the Minnesota situation, you would be a really good fit to be in that room as a veteran who can help a young, talented guy do what you had to go through. And we want you in that regard.
I think that's right. And, you know, the idea of, you know, given a quarterback like, say, a Baker Mayfield, for example, a package of plays to run, so you don't have to run him out there and put everything on his plate, I think is a very good one because, you know, you and I have talked about this a little bit on RSP Film Rooms and elsewhere, but we're asking 22, 23-year-old guys to become a franchise, to do all of the things that you have to do to help, in some cases, a flailing franchise like Cleveland become relevant, to get to a Super Bowl, to get to the playoffs, to win games, while they're figuring out how to be an adult for the first time in their lives, which, like it or not, that's important to consider and remember, because these guys have been, you know, in structured and, you know, intended type environments where they knew where they're going to eat, get their meals from. They didn't have to worry about stuff like that, or maybe not worry about it as much. Obviously, guys come from different backgrounds, but now they have to go and do it all on their own and balance a checkbook and handle finances and pay for insurance and make sure the lights don't get turned off. So there's also that. And so putting a limited, you know, package on these guys' plates is a good thing, I think. Now, obviously, it's not a one-size-fits-all. I think you handle these guys differently. But a wise man once wrote, deny emotion, you only see a fraction of the game. And I think you know who that person is. And I think it's true. We have to remember that there is an emotional aspect to this and that they have to be handled differently. And I know you've written a lot about the way that Schottenheimer handled Drew Brees, which I think speaks to exactly your point, which is you – give them enough rope. When they make a mistake, you pull them back in. And I think the swimming analogy is a perfect one. You can't let somebody learn how to swim by putting them in front of a, you know, a chalkboard and drawing diagrams. At some point, they're going to have to get in the pool, but you can't leave them in the pool. You got to take them out sometime. And if they start, if their doggy paddle turns into a dead man's float, you get them out of the pool before it's really a dead man's float. So.
Yeah, and if you're going to put floaters on them while they're swimming, maybe you, at first you make sure they know how to get the floaters on right. And some of those guys may look at that kid and go, well, he looks strong, he's big for his size, he looks like
he's Josh Allen athletic, and he puts the floater on his head and thinks it's going to work that way.
Right, exactly. Or he's or he's Johnny Manziel and he's trying to make a party favor out of it. We're going to have a lot more with Mark and I with future podcast episodes. We're going to transition over to a conversation that I had with Doug Farrar as he talks about his book, The Genius of Desperation, which is available for pre-order at Amazon.com. And I am John L. Williams, and my guest is Kurt Warner. Actually, I'm Matt Waldman, and I am joined today by one Doug Farrar, who you've probably known in the past from Football Outsiders, his current work with Bleacher Report, the work that he did at Sports Illustrated. And he has a new book out called The Genius of Desperation, which we're going to talk about. Doug, it's terrific to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Well, I appreciate it. I remember our Senior Bowl eats very well, so it's good to talk to you again. I just want to say before we start, this is being recorded the morning we heard of Anthony Bourdain's death. And it's interesting that we're talking about writing right now, because I'm going back and reading his stuff, and he's really got me thinking about process and how important it is to write about people as opposed to things. And it had me going back and kind of checking the book, like, did I do that enough? Did I do character study? Because I think the best writing is about people no matter what the subject. And it really brought that home for me.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly condolences to the Bourdain family and I've loved his show. And, you know, I woke up probably about an hour ago. It was a late night, and You know, the first thing that I saw was that news. So I appreciate that you mentioned that. So,
yeah, I mean, he's insane because the show was great. And then it reminds me of Myron Cope, the Steelers broadcaster who everyone knew for double yoy. And then you go read his stuff in Sports Illustrated. And it's like, oh, my God, this guy was unbelievable. I think his writing was even better.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I can only imagine. And because you listen to him talk and he talks like a writer. Yep. So, you know, just the way that he tells stories and some of the parenthetical thoughts that he has and just the self-awareness and the awareness of a variety of things going on that he wants to encompass. He wanted to encompass in one statement. You could definitely see that with him. So, Doug, let's talk a little bit about your work. I mean, you know, the book is in pre-sale right now, at Amazon, and that's where you can get it, correct? That's the main outlet right there. So tell us a little bit about the basics of the book and what you learned from your research about the game that surprised you.
You know, it's interesting. I came up with this idea 5 years ago after I read a book by the English author Jonathan Wilson called Inverting the Pyramid, which is a history of soccer tactics throughout the world. And I thought, my God, this is amazing. And there has to be a book about this, like, you know, a book like this about professional football. And I discovered, you know, there was Dr. Z's Thinking Man's Guide, which is indispensable. And Pat Kerwin came up with Keep Your Eye on the Ball, you know. But certainly The Games That Changed the Game by Greg Cosell and Ryan Jaworski. And I'm reading all these and I'm like, these things come close to what I want to read, but there isn't a sort of, you know, the arc doesn't go chronologically from the beginning of the NFL to now. And really, I just started writing what I wanted to read. So 5 years ago, it took me about 2 years. Like, why doesn't Chris Brown write this? Why doesn't Mike Tanya write this? You know, like, why doesn't someone better than me write this? You know, somebody who knows more. Chris Brown knows 45 times more about football than I do. I'm like, Jesus Christ. And I was sitting, because Mike Tanya is my Bleacher Report colleague and probably my best friend in the business. Super Bowl and Combine every year, we just sort of Velcro together and hang out. And 2 years back, we were at the Ram in Indianapolis during the combine. I was talking about, I don't know how to do this. I don't know where to start. And Mike, in his sort of avuncular Philly/New Jersey way, said, just effing do it. And it was one of those like galvanic moments where I thought, okay, I'm just going to effing do it. And the process was interesting because, of course, the longest thing I'd ever written was like 20 pages for a team chapter in a, you know, Football Outsiders Almanac, which I contributed to for years. Like, okay, how do you write a book? And I knew about free writing as a generative device. So I what do you know? What are you passionate about? Start there. What are you confident in? And I started there, and that was mostly recent history. So the book is organized by decade. So I actually started writing the book backwards, and I wrote the entire book backwards. I started with the 2000s in a chapter called Back to School. And then I wrote about the 90s and then the 80s and then the 70s. And I split the 60s into two chapters, the AFL and the NFL. And I wrote the entire book backwards because it was the most comfortable way to do it. And it would seem to provide the fewest obstacles to getting the damn thing done. So I got about half of it, maybe 60% of it written. And then Triumph Books, Jeff Fidotin, who's currently my editor, had seen an article I'd done on Dr. Z for SI in 2013. And they were coming out with the Dr. Z sort of compilation edited by Peter King, which is really good, came out last year. And they asked me for a blurb for the back cover, which was, you know, certainly more than I expected. And I thought, you know, I had shopped it with one agent who told me that it's a great idea, but what I should do is scrap what I'm doing and just talk to a bunch of coaches. So it's kind of like, I'm just going to do this on spec and publish it myself. Screw this industry. I don't, you know, I had been in the music business for years and tried to make it. And you know, if this is how it's going to go, hell with it. I'll put it up on CreateSpace and do whatever. But they reached out to me and they sent me the Dr. Z book. And I'm like, okay, they know who I am. They're obviously interested in intelligent writing about schematic history. They might be interested in this book. So I reached out to Michelle Bruton, who's now at FanSided, who was at Triumph, and said, you know, I had already done a 29-page book proposal. I had this whole thing set, and it just there didn't seem to be a lot of interest. So I reached out to Michelle, said, here's the book idea. What do you think? And she said, well, put a proposal together and send it to me. And I sent it to her that day. And like a month and a half later, I had a deal. And then it's like, okay, the 2017 season is starting, and they want this done by January. So that was fun.
A big challenge with what you're doing at Bleacher Report, especially when you're also, you know, kind of helping manage a group of guys who are, you know, scouting what, the BR 1000 at that time?
NFL 1000, yeah. To your question of what I learned, I mean, it's funny, you go into these things, and I mean, you've been writing RSPs for years. I'm sure you know how this is. You go into it thinking, I have to be an expert at everything. And you learn so much more in the process of writing than you impart, I think, if you're doing it right. Because that means you're challenging yourself, and you know, you write 2.5 paragraphs, and then you come to a pothole, and you're like, oh crap, what do I do now? I have to go research. And, you know, so many little things. In the first chapter, which covers 1920 to 1950, I do multiple pages on a guy named Clark Shaughnessy, who most people have never heard of, and was by far the most innovative football mind before Paul Brown. George Halas, Shaughnessy was a coach at the University of Chicago, and he met Halas at a dinner and started talking about, you know, I have all these radical additions to the T formation, which was sort of the de facto formation in the NFL at the time. So Halas switched the place cards so Shaughnessy could sit next to him, and he hired Shaughnessy as a consultant. And Shaughnessy created the T formation that allowed the Bears to beat the Redskins 73-0 in the 1940 NFL championship. Shaughnessy then went to be an assistant with the Rams in the late 40s. And the owner of the Rams got to know Shaughnessy and fired the head coach because he thought Shaughnessy knew more. One of the first things Shaughnessy did was look at one of his tailbacks and think, I think this guy might be a better receiver. Well, that was Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch. And by switching Hirsch from tailback to receiver, he created the three receiver set and thus the modern offense. And the point of minute Rams were created. And that was really, because it was pre-Paul Brown in the NFL, it was really the first NFL offense that you could look at then and go, this wouldn't be completely out of place now. He then he became a defensive consultant. And when Red Hickey brought the shotgun into prominence in the late 50s, he brought Bill George as a linebacker into the old middle guard spot when it was, you know, 12-man fronts and there was nobody in the secondary. And he did that. And it was because football, especially professional football, it's not like baseball where everything seems to have, you know, everything has an origin in baseball, just about. With football, I mean, sacks weren't kept as a stat until 82. There's so much we don't know. And you think about, like, the defensive numbering system, which is, it's credited to Bear Bryant. It's credited to Bum Phillips. It was actually, I'm looking this, because I didn't get the name right. Ralph Jones, who was Halas's freshman coach. Halas hired to coach Chicago's offense, and Jones came up decades before it's thought. He widened splits and came up with the current system of terminology to the game, numbering the gaps and creating the first, I mean, not first, but kind of the evolution of basic play calls. And from the late 30s through the early 40s, the Bears had, I mean, one of the best 4 to 5 year records of all time. And it's because they had these innovators. And so there were all kinds of things I learned that went against common perception. I hope that's what one of the things people will find interesting about the book is, like, you thought it was this and it's actually that. Pretty much. And there's a lot of that. You look at Red Hickey, who was the Niners head coach in the late 50s and early 60s. Not a great head coach, but certainly an offensive innovator. He brought the shotgun, which is the de facto formation of the NFL now, into prominence in the late 50s. He then became a consultant for Tom Landry for years. And in the mid-70s, the Cowboys were the first NFL team to really use the shotgun after the Bears blew it apart with Clark Shaughnessy's innovations in the early 60s. And there was one game between LA and Washington in which the fans booed the formation. The shotgun was seen in the late 70s. You know, we play power football. This is not what you do. So a lot of innovations, you know, just crediting people for things that happened in ways that were not previously known to me was one of the biggest challenges and one of the biggest rewards of the book. And when I finally got it done and was able to look back and go, man, I didn't know that. And I think that was the biggest myth busting I did in this book, is just because you don't know everything about something, that's no reason not to write the book. If you know half of what you need to know, that's the reason to write it, because you can get the other half in research. And once you're really aligned to that project, you're going to go at it all the more.
I recommend everyone to go out and check out Doug's new book, available at Amazon, The Genius of Desperation. And I look forward to having you back on where we can talk a little bit more also about current players in the game. In the meantime, check out more of my RSP casts. You can find them on iTunes. You can find them also on Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Please subscribe. Give me a rating. Give me a little feedback. That's always appreciated. And you can also check out more of my content at my YouTube channel, the RSP Film Room, my site, www.mattwaldmanrsp.com, and on Twitter at Matt Waldman.